Morning, counsel.
Good morning, Your Honor.
Please proceed, counsel.
Thank you. Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Juan Rocha, and I'm here on behalf of the petitioner, Mr. Edwin Cancinos Mencia, who is actually here in the courtroom. This court should reverse the Board of Immigration's published opinion in this case and remand the case back to the Board of Immigration Appeals. The first issue here that was raised was that the immigration judge, just to keep them separately, I will use their names, Ms. Spencer Walters, failed to apply any standard of review when applying the modified categorical approach. And that's important because the second issue dovetails into the first issue, which is, did the government establish or carry its burden of proof by clear and convincing evidence based on the documents that were submitted to Judge Spencer Walters in that case?
This came to her on a remand from the board, and the prior ruling, which she indicated she had read, mentioned the standards, as did your own briefing papers on remand reminded her of the standard. So, I mean, why isn't this just a case where she didn't happen to mention the magic words of saying, you know, the clear and unequivocal and convincing, but the context makes clear that that was applied?
You're right. I believe there's two reasons for that. One, I think in her order, she says that the procedural posture, the history of the case may be referred in the court's decision of September 16, 2016. So she sort of references, or in my opinion, pays lip service to that. And in the reply brief that I filed, I noted the case Singh, which indicates that this court's supervisor duties over these lower courts is to ensure that they actually apply, not just sort of resuscitate the standard of review here. And it's our belief here that she didn't do that. She didn't actually apply the correct standard or any standard of review. And so simply by resuscitating what it could have been, which there's no mention that in her order, that it was clear and convincing evidence, we think that that alone should be a basis for the remand. And so that, as I said, dovetails into the second issue, Your Honor, which is, did the government carry its burden of proof by clear and convincing evidence that Mr. Cancinos, his underlying conviction is a crime of violence? And we believe it isn't. And so here I think there...
Counsel, what's the crime in this case?
Your Honor, Mr. Cancinos pleaded guilty to violating the aggravated assault statute in Arizona, which is ARS 13-1204A2. And then because it's an aggravated felony, it's ARS 13-1203A. But there's no mention of any subsection there. Now,
Before we get there, are you saying that the conviction for that crime was not for a crime of violence under those sections?
That's correct. Under the modified categorical approach, I think this court has made it plain and clear that Arizona's aggravated assault statute is a divisible statute. That goes, I think both sides agree to that, that's the case. So now we apply the modified categorical approach. And I believe the department in this case has mentioned that because there was a criminal complaint that seemed to track the language of subsection A2 of 12043, that combined with the admission that Mr. Cancinos made during the change of plea colloquy suffices to show that the government has carried its burden of proof. But I note, and the government doesn't dispute this, that Mr. Cancinos did not actually plead guilty to the complaint. There was an indictment filed in this case, and the government did not actually produce or generate that during the termination evidentiary hearing that Judge Spencer Walters had in this case. They didn't do that. And so, as I noted in my reply brief, the state of Arizona says whenever there's an indictment that's filed, it supersedes a complaint. Now, the department says, well, both defense counsel and the immigration judge both referenced the complaint. I'm sorry, the Superior Court judge referenced the complaint. So they were referring to a complaint. But even if that's the case, that was incorrect. And the verb that the department uses in their answering brief is, well, we can assume that it was transposed, you know, that's what happened here. And that's just not the case. There was an indictment.
That's true, counsel. Is it your argument that the board could not look at the complaint as part of its evaluation of the case?
Yes, that's my position. Because there's an indictment, of course, I'm not saying it could never do so. I'm just saying in this case, there was an indictment. And that's true of the Marcia Costa case, the Sahagun Gallegos case. There was indictments that were levied in that case, and they looked at the indictment. Here, there was no indictment, so it's unclear what the grand jury returned as far as a probable cause statement for the true bill for that indictment. We don't know that because it was never submitted to the court.
Doesn't our precedent permit looking at any of the documents that are in the record to ascertain what the crime of conviction was and try to use whatever information can be gleaned from those documents to determine that?
Yes, it does. The court knows there's a certain limited number of documents. And
is the complaint one of the documents that can be looked at?
Your Honor, it can be. But our position is that because it was superseded by the indictment, that could have changed the complaint. So we don't know exactly what the grand jury returned as an indictment. We don't know that. And because it supersedes the complaint isn't something that would help us determine whether or not Mr. Cancino's plea was actually rested on the necessary elements of the generic offense. That's our position.
But yes, but we're looking at whether or not there was clear and convincing evidence presented. And if the board said there was, whether or not the board was erroneous in that determination. And so the argument that there was an indictment issue, does that mean, in your view, that there was not clear and convincing evidence?
My view is that we don't have all the information to determine whether or not Mr. Cancino's plea necessarily rested on those elements. That's my contention. It's why I'm asking this panel to reverse and remand to the immigration court to be able to make that application in this case, because we don't know what exactly that was. And the fact that that wasn't used both in the immigration court and the BIA, they both referenced the complaint. We think that is what makes this finding erroneous. Now, even assuming that, Your Honor, we apply the complaint in this case to determine whether the generic elements were satisfied,
I think does the plea agreement itself refer to a complaint or indictment? Does it say what the charging document was?
It does, Your Honor. Now, I know that the answer
it does not.
It does. So, Your Honor,
it does or does not.
So, Your Honor, the plea agreement refers.
I didn't hear your answer. Did you say it does or it does not?
Your Honor, the plea agreement does not reference the indictment. Does not.
Okay.
What it references, and I know that the department raises in their answering brief, what it does raise is that that this plea agreement does not modify a complaint or information. But we know from the record, it's in the administrative record, that there was an indictment in this case.
Correct. But from everything, you're right that an indictment normally supersedes and makes a complaint irrelevant. But then the relevant documents after the indictment are the plea agreement and then the, the minute order and the transcript related to the change of plea. And I didn't see in those documents, the plea agreement, the transcript, or the minute order, any reference to the complaint as opposed to the indictment. Am I wrong on that?
I think it's the reverse, Your Honor. There was no reference to the indictment. There was reference.
There's no
to the
reference
complaint.
To either of them. Nobody says either indictment or complaint.
Well,
I
agree. You're correct, Your Honor. In the change of plea transcript, the Superior Court judge never mentions the indictment, the complaint,
right,
the information.
She just said, here's a charge, and it's under this set, and I'm going to take a plea to it, and here's a plea agreement. And the plea agreement doesn't say what the charging document is. So it just, everyone had the charge, but nobody knew what the document was.
And that's correct. That's why we believe there was insufficient evidence. So then that's when the Superior Court engages in what I describe as an elimination approach, which is that, well, first he says that there was a reckless disregard of reasonable apprehension of threats or harm. I believe he was referencing maybe A1, A2. There was unclear. And then what the Superior Court judge says is, wait, I'm looking at the statute. So that should tell this panel that, as your Honor has mentioned, there's no reference here to the complaint or the information. So the Superior Court is simply looking at the statute of conviction. She's not looking at any judicially noticeable documents. And then she's asking these questions to defense counsel. And then by process of elimination, she's asking them, well, which one is it?
Well, what she's doing is she's been given a plea agreement that has a particular charge in it. And then in your standard change of plea colloquy, she has to be satisfied there's a factual basis, which means for every element of the offense, there are facts lined up that will check off all the boxes so that the offense is covered by the factual basis. And she was dutifully doing that, and she caught that, wait a minute, it didn't line up. One of the elements is missing. It didn't fit any of the clauses the way it had been laid out. And then she asked a clarifying question, and the clarifying answer locks in the elements of A2 and not any of the others. That's how I read this.
Certainly that is what I think transpired here. But I also note that in the unpublished cases, which you don't believe are not only not authoritative here, but not even persuasive, the Cordova case, and I believe the Diaz-Moreno case, especially the Cordova case, where they're saying even the judge, the immigration judge, Spencer Walter, says, well, I'm not just looking at the complaint or the charging documents. I'm also looking at that Mr. Cancino's assented to the factual basis. So, Your Honor, even taking into account that Mr. Cancino's assented and the Superior Court judge was doing its duty to ensure there was a factual basis, I still note back that there was no charging document here. So I think that's what
there was a charging document, the complaint. And in Ruiz Vidal versus Gonzalez, we said, in undertaking an analysis of the record of conviction, we may consider the charging documents, plural, in conjunction with the plea agreement. So fairly read, doesn't that mean that the complaint can be considered even if there is an indictment as well?
Well, I think that, no, Your Honor. I think that if you look at Marcia Costa and Sahagún Gallegos, both of those, this panel made it very clear that they're both indicted. Even the Junco case that's referenced to in one of those cases, the defendant was indicted. They make reference to the indictment,
right,
not to the complaint.
A complaint. So you're saying that the board has to ignore a complaint if there's a complaint in the record?
I didn't say that. If there was no indictment, then certainly the board, the IJ, can certainly consider that. I'm not saying that. That's certainly a judicially enforceable document.
But that's our cases seem to say they may consider the charging documents, plural.
Sure. There could be a charging document complaint. There could be an information. I just want to underscore here we have an indictment, which we don't know if it amended the subsections of 13, subsection A2. We don't know that. We don't have that information.
I'm not understanding why the absence of the indictment makes a difference. Is it your theory that maybe the indictment said A1 and she took a plea to A2?
It's possible. We don't know.
Would
Your
that
Honor.
Matter? Because she took the plea to A2. And there's not much doubt about reading the transcript that that's what she took the plea to, and so that was what the conviction was for. Maybe that was a variance for the indictment, but that's kind of a state law issue that doesn't affect the resulting conviction for immigration purposes.
I agree, Your Honor, that that happened here to sustain this conviction. But under the modified categorical approach, it's clear from DeCamp, from Moncrief, that when you don't have a charging document that narrows the conviction, it doesn't really matter what the defense attorney or what the defendant, in that case, assented to, because you don't have a charging document that narrows the conviction or the elements or the alternative elements. So that's what's the difference here. So that's how I would distinguish here that's why this is important here, because we're establishing someone's removability here, not simply someone's conviction. And so I'd like to reserve the last time here for my rebuttal, so I will accede here to the department.
Thank you, counsel. We'll hear from the government.
May it please the court, Lindsay Corliss for the respondent. This court should deny the petition for review. So this court has already addressed in precedential decisions many of the most pertinent questions related to this case. First, we know that petitioner's statute of conviction, that's Arizona Revised Statute Section 1203A, is divisible into its subparts A1, A2, and A3. And we already know that applying the modified categorical approach to those, that A2 and A3 are aggravated felonies, crimes of violence, and that A1 is not an aggravated felony, crime of violence. So we're here today to make sure that the agency properly looked at the Shepherd documents in order to determine that this petitioner was convicted under Arizona Revised Statute Section 1203A2 and not under A1. So I'm about to get into my argument there, but just given the discussion that just went on, I did want to address quickly the issue with the indictment. The indictment is not in the record. However, it is not true that he did not that he pled to the indictment. He pled to the amended complaint. You can
Where in the record is there any support for that assertion? I don't see it.
So the amended complaint is at page 415 on the record, and then in paragraph 4, it says that this complaint, this plea agreement, serves to amend the complaint or information. So page 415, paragraph 4, and the paragraph 3 right above it says what charges from the complaint are going to be changed. So do you see what I'm saying? It's like kind of at the bottom. There's a 3, a number, and it says the following charges are dismissed. And then it says allegations of dangerous in count 1 and count 2. And then T4 says this agreement serves to amend the complaint or information.
Right, but that could be amending the this agreement serves from – okay. So you're saying the fact that it says complaint or – there's the reference that I had missed in the document to whether it was a complaint or an indictment?
Right. And so then – and we also – oh,
I'm
sorry.
I mean – it's kind of standard. It's certainly true under the federal system that an indictment, the complaint's irrelevant. You can't take a plea to a complaint after there's an indictment.
Well, so two things on that. First, and this is really my point, is that if he has a problem with the fact that he pled to his complaint, which he clearly did, if you look on the record at 350 where he's doing his plea agreement, he is pleading to the amended complaint. But if he has
at
a problem with
plea
that...
Hearing? But, at the change of plea hearing?
At the change of plea hearing.
What page are you?
So 350. So the last part is says the court, the card
part above
it. What page
of the transcript is it? Because it appears several places.
It does.
And I have a different
copy. Okay.
So
this is the. I think this is the first time this transcript might be listed in the record.
No,
it's on page
350. Within the 19 pages of the transcript.
Oh, within the 19 pages of the transcript.
Give me that number.
There's a number. Oh, number 9.
Number 9. Okay.
So you see him, you know, and we can actually even, we could probably go, so actually, sorry, look at number 8. It says, paragraph 3 tells me that based on your plea of guilt to count 1 as it's been amended, so we're going back to count 1 of the amended plea, or the count 1 of the complaint as it's been amended by the plea
but
agreement.
But it doesn't say the word complaint there.
It doesn't there. We do. If you want to look for a complaint, I'm looking at 350 on the next page.
I looked through this whole. I couldn't find the word complaint
okay.
in it.
Mr. Newfield says, yes, on the date, time, and location listed in the complaint and within Maricopa County and within the jurisdiction of this court, defendant recklessly placed the victim in reasonable apprehension of imminent injury. That's on page 350, so or page 9 of the amended plea agreement. I mean, no, sorry, page 9 of the change of plea hearing.
Right, but I don't see anything there about indictment.
No, there's no. He didn't plead to the indictment.
Oh, on the date, time, and listed in the complaint. Okay.
Yes, our position is that if he has a problem with the fact that he pled to his complaint, that really is a collateral issue for the criminal courts. It's not before this court here. If this court wants to satisfy itself that it's okay to plead to the to a complaint rather than to an indictment, I do have a citation for the court. Although I don't think that it's correctly before this court as an issue. But if you want to look it up, State versus Wilson, 126 Arizona 348, and that's the Court of Appeals from 1980. And that kind of, it's a case that really goes through how, the process of a complaint or an indictment and how a plea agreement can change either one of them. So that if that's helpful to the court, then that's that. But like I said, it is a collateral issue. He pled to the complaint. But turning back to the Shepherd documents and whether or not the agency properly found sufficient documents in order to support finding that this person was convicted under 1203A2. So starting backwards back at that change of plea hearing, we first have petitioner entering his plea of guilty. And when the judge asks for a factual basis for that plea, his attorney responds, defendant recklessly placed the victim in reasonable apprehension of imminent injury. Now, that phrase, place the victim in reasonable apprehension of imminent injury, is verbatim the actus reus from A2 in the statute. Recklessly, however, is not an A2. So at that point, the judge really, she does her job in order to make sure that this defendant's rights are preserved, and she says, okay, this isn't making sense, these things don't align, let's make sure that we get it right. So she says on the next page, so just a moment, I'm looking at the mens rea out of 13-1203. Now you said recklessly. And then she goes on to quote from the statute three different options. And all of these phrases are verbatim from the statute at A1, A2, and A3. She says, when I look at assault, you can intentionally, knowingly, or recklessly cause physical injury, which he didn't hear. Then she quotes A2. You can intentionally place another person in reasonable apprehension of imminent physical injury, or, and here comes A3, you can knowingly touch another person with intent to injure, insult, or provoke. And I'm having trouble embracing that mens rea. And at that point, petitioner's counsel says, okay, intentionally place the other in reasonable apprehension or fear. And then critically, the court says to the defendant, and do you agree with that? And at that point, the defendant assents. Now, under this court's precedent, in Diaz-Moreno, which is a case that we cited in our 28J letter, that is sufficient. In Diaz-Moreno, the statute at issue there was a drug statute, and the missing element that was in none of the other documents, not the complaint, not an indictment, there was a missing element of what drug was at issue. The only time it was ever mentioned was at the plea colloquy during the factual recitation, and the attorney provided the information, stated that the drug at issue was cocaine. Then, critically again, the defendant assented to that, and this court, found that sufficient evidence of the existence of a conviction in order to satisfy the modified categorical approach. But if this court is not satisfied just by following Diaz-Moreno, we do have, as we've discussed earlier, that complaint as amended by the plea agreement, which is at 415. Now, the complaint itself is at page 429 of the record.
Can I ask you a hypothetical question? Because I understand now, and I had not caught that complaint is mentioned both in the plea agreement, and then it's mentioned, as you noted, on page 9 of the transcript. But suppose the plea agreement and the transcript have both referenced the indictment.
Yes.
So they'd said the indictment, and everything else is the same, but the indictment is missing.
Right.
Would you lose then, or would it be the same result? And if so, why?
If that were the case, I kind of can't imagine that petitioner would not have brought that issue up before the immigration judge. I mean, this is part of the issue here is when there was an opportunity for them to put the indictment into the record, that issue was not raised. So we do have an exhaustion issue here, and it's kind of showing us why that's a problem, because we are stuck with the record that we have right now, and the record we have right now doesn't have an indictment. I would say that it's going to raise some questions if they're referencing the indictment. But at the same time, if the only evidence that we have says A2 under Diaz-Moreno, then that would be sufficient. But I do think that there would have been prior argument about where is this indictment.
Well, suppose the indictment were in the record
and
showed A1.
Yeah.
But she took the plea to A2, very clearly took a plea to A2, and then there's a conviction. What would be the answer then?
Well, if she took the plea to A2, then that is what she was convicted of.
So that would be a state law error, but
Yeah, actually, there's a case Lima, where that kind of situation arose, and that is cited in our brief. And the premise of that case is essentially this court saying, if your plea agreement got rid of what you said in the indictment because it changed it, well, then that indictment is dead. So you can't rely on that if you have the change of plea. And in Lima, the plea agreement didn't get to all of the elements of the offense, and so that in that case, in Lima, they said not enough evidence for a conviction. But the whole point of that case was to say that what matters is what you ultimately pled to. Now, what you ultimately pled to, we might have a little more hint of that if we're looking at the charging documents, but really what matters is what you actually pled to. So I just wanted, just very quickly, because I'm running out of time, I just wanted to just mention that, once again, that complaint does say verbatim, it's page 429, that the petitioner intentionally placed the victim in reasonable apprehension of imminent physical injury. So we do have verbatim the same language as is in the statute. Unless there are any questions on that issue, I did want to quickly touch upon the clear and convincing evidence standard issue that has been brought up. So petitioner is arguing that because the immigration judge did not specifically state the clear and convincing evidence standard, that she didn't use any standard at all. That's not true. So she did apply a standard, so it's our job to figure out what standard she applied. It's not actually an error for the immigration judge to not state the standard. It's certainly an error for her to not apply the standard. So it's very helpful sometimes when they do state the standard, because then you can see, okay, she's stating the standard, she knows what the standard is, and, you know, this evidence satisfies it or doesn't satisfy it. And it's easy to review it, but like I said, it's not an error not to state it. So let's look at, since she didn't state it, let's look at the evidence of what she actually did. At the very base of that, we do have the presumption of regularity. The immigration judge is a government official. There is a presumption that she's going to discharge her duties, including using the correct standard of review, and especially when we're dealing with what is the most basic standard of immigration law. You know, it's not a standard that's in flux. If you want to find someone removable, it has to be because there is clear and convincing evidence of their removability. But so we start with that, and then you have to look, is there any evidence in this record to overcome that presumption? And we don't have any evidence of that. Petitioner didn't point to any evidence that she weighed against it that might tell us, oh, she's actually using a preponderant evidence standard. It's not like she said this evidence is more persuasive than this evidence. She wasn't weighing evidence in a way that made you think that she was doing a different standard. We also see her that she is relying on the type of evidence that this court has found in other precedential decisions to be clear and convincing evidence. So she's relying on the right kind of evidence that would say, that we consider to be clear and convincing. We also have the history of this case to look at. She not only did she mention in her decision that she reviewed the prior decisions and record, she actually discusses on page 81 of the record with both petitioners and government counsel what she had done and what she had reviewed, including the transcripts of prior proceedings and decisions. So she discussed that she had reviewed that. And we have, in her review, she would have come across at least three statements of the correct clear and convincing evidence standard. Page 290, the very first immigration judge orally finds that DHS sustained its burden by clear and convincing evidence, and then in a written decision on pages 233 and 236, the second immigration judge used that standard twice and stated that standard twice. Finally, I'll just mention that the decision itself includes a burden shifting. As soon as she finishes the removability portion of her decision, the immigration judge states that petitioner has the burden to show that he is eligible for relief, and he has to do it by preponderant evidence. If she weren't shifting her burden from one thing to another, she probably wouldn't have said so. But I do see I am out of time, so unless the court has questions, I will rest.
It appears not. Thank you,
Kate. Okay, thank you so much.
Rebuttal.
So the department explains that this is something about the complaint that should have been brought up by Mr. Cancinos during the time of the evidentiary hearing with the immigration judge. But it's our position that that would be illegal burden shifting. It's their burden of proof, not respondents. We agree that it's respondents in the immigration judge context to prove eligibility for relief. We concede that. But it's their burden of proof by clear and convincing evidence to show that. So if they didn't prove the indictment, that's on the department.
But now we have, I mean, the two indicia in the plea agreement and in the transcript that, in fact, the plea was taken to the complaint. And maybe that was messed up under Arizona law, but is that something we can consider? That the conviction still results.
Again, there's a conviction here for purposes of the state, but is it a deportable offense for purposes of the Immigration Nationality Act for an aggravated crime of violence? I would say no, because it's their burden. It's in the record. They have never said that it doesn't exist. What could have happened with that, of course, is only between the Superior Court and Defense Counsel. I just want to mention that there's the government cites to Moreno-Diaz, the unpublished case, to say that the colloquy is sufficient, even if you don't have the indictment or the other charging document. But I just want to note that that document or that case, Diaz-Moreno, conflicts with Marcia Costa, where it says you need the charging document and some sort of assent by the defendant, the respondent, to satisfy the modified categorical approach. So Diaz-Moreno just essentially ignores precedent and just finds that the colloquy is enough. So we don't think that case has any precedential or persuasive value. Your Honor, I know that I'm out of time, so unless the panel has any questions, I ask that the court reverse the BIA and remand the case back to the immigration court. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Thank you to both counsel. The case just argued is submitted for a decision by the court. That completes our calendar for the morning. We are in recess until 9:30 a.m. tomorrow morning.